Today, an interview with the Crown actor, Tobias Menzies, about getting inside the mind and body of Prince Philip. When did you first get the call about the Crown?
I actually got a call from my agent saying that they had been kind of discussing my name about it, but that they felt I was too young. And I thought, oh, well, that's nice to be thought of, and then kind of got on with my life.
And then they realised how old you were.
harsh but fair.
No, I'm joking.
And then they sort of came full circle. And then actually it happened quite quickly when it happened, as I went in, taped with Olivia, and about a week and a half later, yeah, we would go.
Playing Prince Philip in the Netflix blockbuster The Crown would prove to be an acting challenge like no other for Tobias Menzies. Here was a character who everyone sees, but hardly anyone knows. There is a unique curiosity about the royal family in Britain. In the days after Prince Philip's death, broadcasters gave over their entire schedules to make way for obituaries. And of course, they will televise the funeral tomorrow before a period of national mourning ends on Sunday. So what was it like to play him?
I actually found it quite hard to pin down in a way. He's a contradictory person. There's a lot of different forces, it felt, at play within him a lot of the time. So it immediately struck me that he was someone who was very wary to show his feelings, to kind of self-reveal. And yet, atmospherically, he's not a cool presence. He's quite hot. You know, he's abrasive, he's challenging, he's funny. But there's an energy about it. It's not calm, it's not gentle. And those things seem to be kind of warring inside him.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Becoming Prince Philip. An interview with Tobias Menzies. You've obviously done some big roles. I mean, you played a 17th century soldier in Outlander and a medieval prince in The Game of Thrones. Mm. How did this one compare to them?
Well, I guess the obvious difference is that you're playing someone that everyone thinks they know. He's one of the most photographed, filmed people in the world. So probably anyone you speak to could do a sort of dodgy impression of him. And so the initial challenge is a technical one, because in order for the drama to work, you have to get close enough to that and to how he sounds and how he moves to allow the audience to kind of go, oh yeah, that is a bit like him. And that's a sort of slightly magical aspect of The Crown. However, it can't be just an act of mimicry, because I think that becomes quite tiring to watch and distracting. So there's a delicate balance between really getting close to him, but also it's relaxed enough and easy enough on the eye that the audience can then pass through that and go into just the story and these people and their lives.
And I guess, as we've learned over the last few days, this country loves the royal family and Prince Philip's really revered. Was it daunting to take on someone who the public felt that way about?
I suppose I wouldn't entirely agree with your premise in a way. I feel like there's a lot of complexity, I think, in this country's relationship with the royal family.
Yeah.
Even actually within this last few weeks, you know, we've gone from the kind of furore around Harry and Meghan's interview, and then we've seen the response to the death of Philip. And I do agree that it seems that the Queen and Philip are held in a great deal of affection by a lot of people in the country. But did I feel daunted about that? Really, the royal family has not been a big part of my life, I don't think. And in a way, going into this show was the first time that I had really kind of looked at them properly, thought about them. I came from a pretty kind of anti-establishment kind of upbringing, I would guess that would be the best way of saying it. You know, my mum would actively like not have the Queen's speech playing on Christmas Day. And so they weren't part of my life prior to doing the show. So maybe that liberated me to a certain extent to be able to kind of just really see what I saw, see what I found when I started to read and watch him. And I guess I was pretty surprised, actually, at what I found. I found him much more complicated, much more interesting, a lot more going on inside him and his life than maybe I'd expected. Maybe this is a ridiculous thing to say, but I feel there's some of my generation, when we think of Philip, a sort of spitting image puppet kind of pops up. And, you know, for people who've only known him as an older man, he's become a bit of a sort of cliche almost.
You blithering idiot!
But actually just find, you know, how smart he was, how widely read he was, how thoughtful he was about his position. His childhood obviously is an extraordinary story with a lot of trauma inside it.
But when he was still a baby, his family were forced to flee their home. A military coup meant it was no longer safe to stay in Greece.
His mother was then tragically confined to what was called in those days an asylum.
In Philip, you have a person who spent his whole life hiding how he was feeling, really. He's a highly armoured person, it seemed to me. And so something has to be shown, but you have a character who doesn't want to show it.
So were you a Republican when you came into this?
Small R Republican, yeah. I think I still am. Yeah.
I was going to say, definitely not. No. I follow you on Twitter. Definitely not. Capital R
but,
Republican.
Yes, I think on balance, I think it would be more grown up for us to choose a head of state. But I also say that knowing that if you're going to have a constitutional monarchy, I think the Queen does it very, very well. And it could well be that if we elected a head of state, that they would often be worse. And obviously, it's changed over the years, but it can't help but entrench an idea of class and privilege that is still remains powerful.
Okay, so you landed the part. How did you start to research how you were going to play the role?
A lot of interviews. I also read biographies, also worked with a brilliant movement person, Polly Bennett, and she helped me to sort of start to see what he was doing with his body, how he was moving and the kind of rhythm of him.
And what kind of things did she teach you?
So I remember her saying both him and the Queen, and obviously I suppose this is true for all the royals probably, that whenever they go into rooms, there are people looking at them. They are viewed. And so they often will move slowly in order for that process of viewing to occur in a way. That there's something ceremonial about their position which requires them to be seen. And the sort of psychology behind that really helped me, rather than it just being a sort of technical exercise. You're getting partly into kind of what is the emotional dynamic that's going on in a life which is so highly visible. That sort of stuff I really sort of helped me.
And what about the voice?
So the voice,
I mean, I can't think now how it's different to what you're saying now. I'm listening to you and I feel like I'm listening to Prince Philip.
please don't say that's true. Please. Oh, my God.
Sorry.
Where did I start? I mean, I really started, the boring answer to the question is by listening to him so much.
I wouldn't know. Yes, I do it myself.
I mean, is it...
Until I sort of went crazy with it. There's an interview of him on YouTube from sort of 84, which I found really useful. I sort of pretty much played that on loop for 2 weeks.
Well, I never thought of it as a role. I mean, it's just a way of life. I mean, it's just, I just got on with what seems to be the sensible thing to do under the circumstances. I mean, I don't visualise myself as playing a part.
So when it came to understanding the psychology of Prince Philip, what were the most important aspects of his life?
I mean, I guess at the heart of the drama is this relationship, this marriage, within the construct of, you know, this extraordinary ceremonial institution. You know, they're profoundly private people, and that's one of the challenges of bringing both of them to the screen. You know, in some way, unlike the younger generations of royals, they don't say what they think and feel a great deal. And so you're having to imagine your way into them. But one of the things I think you can see is that what Philip seemed to bring to the Queen's life was an ability to make her laugh, to kind of break up the stiffness and the solemnity of a lot of her engagements and all of her life. Sometimes you see them when they're in crowds, and he often is much more kind of engaged with people. or bringing kids over to sort of hand over flowers. So I felt like he helped to humanise her role and her experience.
And they were together for 73 years, as we've heard probably about 100 times over the last few days. She described him as her strength and stay, all of which feels incredibly positive. But I thought that there was a strong implication in the early series that he was not always great to her, and that perhaps that he was unfaithful. And then in your series, you came across like the perfect supportive husband there on the sidelines, but always helping when needed. Was that deliberate by the Crown's writer, Peter Morgan, to try to depict their marriage as changing over time?
You're quite right. In the first two seasons, Peter did address some of the rumours that have swirled around Philip for many years that he has been unfaithful. There's no evidence for that, and I don't know either way. This is where I feel sort of very unqualified to talk authoritatively about this stuff because, you know, I never met him, I didn't know him. And so that sort of very personal stuff about what their marriage really was and whether there was infidelities is pure conjecture, both on the show's part and on mine.
I mean, it's really refreshing to hear you talk so candidly about how it is a dramatisation. And we've done an episode on this in the past, The Crown, Fact and Fiction. And the reason we're all kind of obsessed with this is because I bet a lot of people are a bit like me and you watch it and you basically watch it as if it's part documentary. How do you kind of grapple with that kind of responsibility? The fact that so many people, millions of people will be watching this and thinking, oh yeah, that's what Prince Philip was like.
It makes me nervous, if I'm totally honest, because it really is a highly curated show. Very brilliantly written, incredibly skillful actors bringing it to the screen. But it really isn't documentary. Now, that's not to say that a huge amount of thought and research doesn't go into the show. It really does. But obviously, Peter would then take the many, many events that were going on in their lives and he would choose a handful and through the lens of those events would explore where those people were at that moment in their lives. And that's a profoundly kind of artificial thing to do because that's not how life is. You know, life is generally a bit of a mess of stuff where everything's sort of happening at the same time. And yeah, I suppose only the Queen now could tell us whether at times we get close to what it was really like or what was the atmosphere in that room at that time.
She's not going to do that, is she?
I mean, it would be amazing, but I think it's...
Yeah, when we get our exclusive interview, I'll be sure to put it to her. But you work really hard to try and get as close as you can, and then you accept that the dialogue behind closed doors is dramatised.
Absolutely. And for me, obviously, you know, I'm given a version of Philip through Peter's writing, and then I am adding, I guess, decisions myself about the atmosphere of how I play certain scenes.
Can you give us an example of that?
Maybe a good example is at the beginning of season four, there's a scene after Mountbatten's death where I meet Charles the night before the funeral. And we have this scene where I tell Charles that, you know, Mountbatten wants him to speak at his funeral rather than me. And it's really the only scene that Charles and I have in the two seasons that I did, which is itself quite revealing. It's a really interesting way to show that relationship is through absence, really. But I chose to play that scene that I had been drinking. I mean, he's not a drinker.
When one was as deprived of a father as I was, one can't help feeling, I don't know, territorial of the next best thing.
The reason I did that was that in that scene, he is much more emotionally revealing than really he is at any other time. And that feels very out of character. And so I thought maybe a way to allow myself to speak like this would be that he has been drinking and that something has loosened inside him that allows him to speak so candidly to his son, where normally he wouldn't do that. And so that's obviously an example of me kind of adding something to what Peter has written and finding a sort of character way for me to say what needs to be said.
And I guess that scene, like many before, tried to get at this relationship between a father and his oldest son that some have suggested has been difficult. I know a lot of this is conjecture, but how did you approach that relationship more broadly?
In terms of Charles, you get a sense that Charles was a sensitive boy. And this was my version of it, that in a way, Charles's vulnerability sort of triggered Philip's vulnerabilities, which Philip didn't want to feel. And so actually he would kind of like rail against Charles for being too soft, because maybe he worried for Charles. He was like, you can't be this sensitive and be in this role. And so maybe in some way he was trying to train his son, trying to give him the tools that he felt he would need going forward. But again, you know, to caveat all that, that's all conjecture on my part. And I'm sure if Philip was sat here, I'm sure he would deny everything I've just said.
It's a certainly nice way of looking at it. And I imagine that being sensitive in that role is not great, because there's a hell of a lot of focus on you.
I would have thought so. I mean, I'm a pretty thin-skinned person. I cannot imagine trying to step into any of those roles. That's certainly something I have gained, is a great deal of sympathy for the position they're in. It's not a life that I would like to live at all.
I was going to ask about that, because to some extent it's portrayed as this kind of magical thing. Like, imagine being part of the royal family, or for women, imagine marrying a prince. But in reality, and watching The Crown, I felt this as well, essentially you end up incredibly isolated. I mean, to be that famous means you can't ever pop to the shops or go to the pub or even be sure that your friends are genuine. Did you come away really thinking about that side of it?
Absolutely. If I, and I don't think I did have, but if I ever had any kind of fantasies of what that life might be, they were entirely stripped away by really kind of studying them and looking into their lives. It's, I think, a very, very strange role, strange life with, yes, as you say, great privilege baked into it, but very little privacy, like genuine privacy. And obviously they can sort of disappear to their castles and they do the best they can. But to thinking about my life, I love mooching about London. You know, I like to walk around. I like to watch the world go by. They can never do that.
But you must understand a touch of it as a celebrity. I mean, you must be recognised. I don't know, how much does it affect your life?
Yes, and I find it really uncomfortable. Partly just that's my personality, but also one of the sources of acting is watching the world, you know, behaviour, all the kind of weirdnesses of life and how people are. And if that world starts looking at you, then you can't watch it the same. And so when I see Philip in those interviews, his irritability about the attention he receives and the kind of personal questions.
I'm not answering that question.
I would be exactly the same, if not worse, I think. I would be very short-tempered as well. For someone who clearly was not comfortable with it, I think he managed to do it with quite a high degree of dignity and sort of patience.
By the end of his life, Philip had completed 22,219 royal engagements.
And apparently, say that number again. That's a good number.
22,219.
That's a lot. That's a lot of ribbons to cut, isn't it? I mean,
is a lot of ribbons. And apparently 22% of us have met him or seen him in person. I did once. All of which was important.
You got some serious stats. That's amazing.
Wow. I know.
That's good.
Because all of that is really an important thing to do. But he'd given up this rising naval career for a role basically playing second fiddle.
It's naturally disappointing, because I'd just been promoted to commander. And in fact, the most interesting part of a naval career was just starting. But then equally, if I stopped and thought about it, well, being married to the Queen, it seems to me that my first duty was to serve her in the best way I could.
One of the things it felt like you guys were trying to do was look at how that impacted on him. That episode in season three, all about Philip's obsession with the moon landing, that really captured that sense of frustration.
Do you think those astronauts up there are catatonic like you lot? Of course not. They are too busy achieving something spectacular.
In fact, he's described himself as the world's most experienced plaque unveiler and wants nothing but a bloody amoeba. Did playing the role make you think about what it must have been like to have to do all those things and to be the person by the side of the Queen?
Yes. And for someone who clearly had a lot of energy, who was interested, well-read, had a lot that he could offer, for that personality to be inside a almost entirely ceremonial position is fascinating. I mean, it's the stuff of Greek drama. In some ways, I don't think you could have designed a role less suited to that man. And what's interesting about the effect he's had on that institution and on that family is he took that essentially completely non-role and took it incredibly seriously, applied a huge amount of energy and inventiveness and created a life for himself. And I think the institution itself benefited from that. Of course, I think it was definitely a challenge for him. There are moments when he kind of explodes out of it. I think that's probably where some of these gaffes come from, is it his desire to kind of just sort of mix it up a bit and get a bit of life into the whole proceeding. But I do think there were lots of benefits to that, to someone who didn't play by the rules and wanted to make things work better. And I suppose he wanted to serve. I mean, he did seem to genuinely want to serve this country and contribute meaningfully to the institution that is at the head of this constitutional monarchy.
I mean, I do find it fascinating the way he kind of played shadow to the Queen in many ways, and how interesting that is for a man who had been in the Navy. But I think it's also something quite depressing about society that we focus on that, because we wouldn't, would we, if he was a woman?
I agree. There's obviously something very male about that gaze, to see that as some sort of diminution of him. And again, I think he probably wouldn't accept the premise. I think he probably would have very little time for the kind of psychologizing of what that meant. He would probably say, it didn't mean anything. You know, I was just meant I was a, sort of a few meters behind, and then I just spoke to some different people. And but I suppose part of the reason why maybe we think about that is that he is a man from an earlier generation where I guess that kind of alpha masculinity was more entrenched. And so for a man at that time, when the Queen ascended to the throne, to then have to sort of step down.
It's very unusual.
In that society, it's obviously less unusual now, but then it obviously was very unusual. But again, I think he never complained about it. He did it with a great deal of dignity. And so in that way, you know, maybe he was a bit of a leader.
On the modernisation, one thing he was very interested in was the power of TV. He pushed for the coronation to be televised in 1953 and then invited cameras to come into the palace to show the family as working people in 69, a bit like Big Brother Series 1. Do you reckon that changed our relationship with the royal family?
Yes, I think it did. There's a central contradiction, I think, at the heart of what the royal family are constantly trying to do, because the essential nature of monarchy is that it has to have mystery, I think. You can't just be like the people next door. There has to be some majesty in it. But in order to stay relevant, the royal family has continually needed to innovate and be relevant. And those sort of things don't really sit together. And so the challenge of that, I think, is something that Philip, I think, has been very good at and has been incredibly helpful to the Queen in negotiating how to do that. I'll give you another stat back. I think it's true that there was some polling done in like the 50s, like a Gallup poll, where more people thought that they didn't need the royal family then, and less people say that now. So actually the sort of the popularity of the royal family has increased. And I think that's quite an achievement given how much the nation has changed. And I think I feel he's a big part of that.
Coming up, the controversies, or so-called gaffes. We've been very nice about Prince Philip because it's respectful. He's just died. And let's be honest, if you've been watching the news over the past week, it's a bit, well, my husband put it, it's like the propaganda news. It's kind of like almost North Korea-esque. It's like you're not allowed to criticise the Queen's husband.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree.
So what we hear instead is people saying things like he was straight talking, or we've heard lots of people, as you also said, talking about his gaffes. You know, I think there might be a different way of describing some of them. I just looked through a list. Here are some of them. He said, British women can't cook. He told students, if you stay in China too long, you'll end up slitty-eyed. He said to a woman in Kenya, you are a woman, aren't you? This one I've taken personal offence about at. He said, of an old-fashioned fuse box, it looks as if it was put there by an Indian. And he told a 13-year-old he looked too fat to be an astronaut. And then famously to an Australian Aborigine said, are you still throwing spears? I'll probably lose my job if I go on. But how did you tackle that side of Prince Philip?
I think the honest truth is by ducking it, if I'm completely honest. In a way, it's not what the show engages in. I think what the show is a measured and thoughtful appraisal of that institution and the family that sits inside it. Now, you could definitely criticize that and say that we have added to propaganda about the family. It's essentially quite a benign representation.
It's not all positive. I didn't come away thinking everything was positive.
It's not all positive. It's true. No, it's true. It's true. But I guess it doesn't look to ideas of racism or class or elitism. And my job as an actor within that show is to, I think, to show as much complexity as I can whilst fundamentally being on Philip's side. My job is to try and empathise with why he might say some of those remarks rather than to critique that.
I guess that brings me to my next question, which is at the beginning of this whole process, you said you didn't really know much about him, you hadn't really thought about him, and then you completely immersed yourself in him. And I'm just interested if by the end of it, you ended up liking him. Do you think you would have got on?
Good question. I think I would have been nervous to meet him. He seemed naturally abrasive. I, by contrast, have sort of avoid conflict at pretty much any cost. So, would I have liked him? That's like the million-dollar question, because fundamentally, I have no idea whether that's a good portrayal of who he was. And the truth is, it seems to me that there are quite a few different versions of Philip out in the world. There are people who are great admirers and supporters of his, and who speak very highly about his warmth and his generosity. And there are other people who see him as, you know, absolutely entrenched in an institution that is arcane and out of date. And I guess some would say maybe racist. And so that's where the challenge and the difficulty of playing someone who is that well-known and is part of such a well-known family.
Do you have any idea whether he watched it and what he thought?
My gut instinct would be that he didn't. I would say he wouldn't have been a drama man. I think he would have been like documentaries, like facts. Don't give me any of this sort of, this is what it might have been like. And I think he would have felt it was very narcissistic for him to sit down and watch a drama about his own family and himself. You know? I think he would have had no time for that.
Tobias Menzies, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
That was the actor Tobias Menzies. If you haven't watched The Crown, I would really recommend you do that. Whatever you think of the royal family, it's great television. That is it for today and for this week. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back on Monday.